on February 1st. And they believed the train was broke down because the contents were too heavy that it was carrying. And Norfolk Southern apparently was warned by employees that that train was too heavy and that something like this could happen. So they were having issues with the train anyway. We know the EPA director is coming down today to the site because he wants to encourage that everything's going status quo. But again, like we've said time and time again for almost 2 weeks, we were told only about air, that it was safe. Water, soil, and surface was basically told it was, you know, surface wasn't being done, water and soil was, but it's ongoing.
Emily, we have 20 seconds. Your final comment.
Yeah, people were let back in their homes. So we really need a federal emergency to be declared. We need our Governor DeWine. We absolutely need him to, when he talks to President Biden's administration today or tomorrow, to tell them that we need FEMA in here. There are short-term and long-term effects that will be some of the gravest that this nation has ever seen in a train derailment.
Well, Emily Wright, we're going to continue to follow this story. Development Director for River Valley Organizing in Ohio, speaking to us from Portsmouth, Ohio, just next to East Palestine, where the train derailment took place. The train was 2 miles long with toxic chemicals. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a huge increase in deaths among the houseless population in our area, and what's behind it?
What we weren't prepared for was simply just the use of fentanyl as a drug that became cheap, that became highly available.
Why a Western state is taking Portland to federal court. And teaching students to manage their money, where that could soon be required learning. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 16th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. A record 193 houseless people died in Multnomah County in 2021, representing a 53% increase compared to the previous year. Mirroring trends across the country, substances contributed to about 60% of those deaths. Lead County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines was among those announcing these findings.
This is a report with incredibly high quality data. Our medical examiners are literally boots on the ground talking to families, gathering detailed information. We have reviewers who cross-check references to homelessness to make sure we are in fact looking at homeless deaths. And then we have fairly good reliability around markers like race and ethnicity, and certainly cause and manner of death. There's a relatively small group of people that assemble this data from start to finish. I will acknowledge that it's not ideal to be in 2023 and talking about events from 2021, but I'm glad we're doing it, and I'm glad to be here to look at this report with you all today. Just a reminder that medical examiner deaths are very specific in terms of what deaths fall under the medical examiner's jurisdiction. So they tend to be non-natural deaths, so things like accidents, questions around overdose, certainly homicide and suicide. So they tend to skew younger and more violent. They tend to be non-natural deaths. So I offer that as a really important reminder that this is not the entire universe of deaths among people experiencing homelessness. This is one very high quality set of information, but that is skewed in a certain way because of the nature of the medical examiner's jurisdiction. I also want to acknowledge that part of the timing with this report has to do with just the sheer number of cases that our medical examiners investigate day in and day out. They are 24/7, 365. So high quality data, beautiful humanizing stories in this report. I also just want to point out that we talk about these deaths in absolute numbers. So we all want a denominator, right? We all want to know this year compared to last year, what proportion is what. And we can't do that with this data, unfortunately, because of its nature. So these are absolute numbers that we can look at year over year, but they essentially speak for themselves. And we can talk certainly about trends and numbers, but we can't do the kind of quantitative analysis of these numbers because of the nature of the information itself. So let's move to talk a little bit more about context for the year of 2021, which this report covers. So if you take yourself back to that time, we started the year, calendar year 2021, with a vaccine rollout. So COVID-19 vaccine was just coming out. By later that year, summer, we were looking at the Delta variant and the Delta surge that unfolded in late summer, early fall. And just when we thought we were maybe out of the woods, we had the Omicron variant right around December of that year. That year also saw in June the climate emergency of the heat dome, which is visible in this report if you look at hyperthermia deaths or heat deaths from overheating. It was also the year that spring that we issued our first public alert around fentanyl. And I want to highlight that because for a long time, we imagined that fentanyl was sort of a drug contaminant that people would kind of stumble upon accidentally, and it would be something that might move through the drug supply and create a spike in overdose that we would try to be alert to and respond to. What we weren't prepared for was simply just the use of fentanyl as a drug that became cheap, that became highly available, and that is so potent and short-acting that people actually develop an addiction and seek out the drug itself, even though it carries such high risk of overdose. So that was our first sort of public alert. And now, you know, we are well into that crisis and looking at ways to address that crisis, certainly among people experiencing homelessness, but also more broadly. Finally, I just want to offer some comments about the findings in this report. I'm really, really sad to say that I'm not surprised by the findings in this report. They mirror larger county trends in terms of violent deaths and certainly overdose. I think what's particularly difficult about this report is that we see those trends concentrated among our most vulnerable. So people who literally do not have shelter, experiencing some of the worst of cascading social effects of the COVID-19 pandemic are really on full display here.
That was Dr. Jennifer Vines, Multnomah County's and the Tri-County area's lead health officer. Why a Western state is suing Portland in federal court? KBOO's Josh Salem tells us what this is about.
The state of Montana and a number of fuel industry trade associations are suing Portland because of city policies restricting fuel transport within city limits. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court. It alleges the Portland City Council passed regulations that do not truly address the city's stated goals of reducing its reliance on fossil fuels, while also discriminating against interstate commerce. The complaint says, quote, because the code amendments serve political purposes, they do not resolve the issues they purportedly target, but actually undermine those goals, end quote. The lawsuit was submitted on behalf of the state of Montana, the Western Energy Alliance, the Pacific Propane Gas Association, Idaho Petroleum Marketers, and other petroleum industry groups. The suit targets a number of updates to city code which limit fuel companies' abilities to operate in Portland. In 2016, the city voted to ban the development and expansion of all fuel facilities that hold more than 2 million gallons of fuel and which handle fuel delivered by boat, rail, or pipeline. That policy already immediately faced a court challenge by another fuel industry group, Western States Petroleum Association. The Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals ruled the city had the authority to enact the policy, but had to support the ordinance with more evidence and data in the future. The city renewed and strengthened the policy in 2019 and 2022. The lawsuit specifically calls out the policy's exemptions for fuel used by local airports, shipping ports, and vehicle fleets. The plaintiffs argue that this allows the city to discriminate against export facilities and violates the U.S. Commerce Clause. In 2018, after a second legal challenge to the fuel terminal ban, the Oregon Court of Appeals upheld the city's policy, explicitly pointing out the importance of limiting the number of large fuel terminals in an area threatened by potential earthquakes. Portland City Attorney Robert Taylor declined to comment on the complaint. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The results of a new poll show support for conservation remains strong among people living in Western states. Roz Brown reports on the new conservation in the West Pole and what it shows about public lands, water conservation, and wildlife protection.
Climate change, pollution, impacts from oil and gas drilling, and a strong concern for protecting drinking water are just some of the issues New Mexicans cited as top concerns in a new conservation poll. The Land of Enchantment was one of 8 Western states in which residents were asked about issues and policies related to the outdoors. The State of the Rockies poll has been conducted by Colorado College the past 13 years. Mete Arce with the Hispanic Access Foundation says conservation is especially important to people of color because they are being affected the most by the Colorado River crisis.
When we talk about conservation, we're talking about much more than protecting land, waters, and climate that surrounds us. Conservation is also having to do with our health, the economy, work, and social justice.
New Mexico is among 7 Western states that get some of their water from the Colorado River. Distribution is guided by the 100-year-old Colorado River Compact. Late last month, participating states missed a federal deadline to agree on water use to meet the river's declining capacity. That decision is now in the hands of the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. In New Mexico, 85% of those polled support achieving a national goal of conserving 30% of land and inland waters in America and 30% of ocean areas by 2030. Arce says research shows that communities of color are 3 times more likely to live in a place that's nature-deprived than their white counterparts.
Nature's supposed to be a great equalizer. In reality, however, American society distributes nature's benefits and the effects of its destruction and decline unequally by race, income, and age.
Arce also notes that 87% of respondents said they support ensuring Native American tribes have greater input on decisions made about areas on national public lands that contain sites sacred or culturally important to their tribe. This is Roz Brown.
Conservation can actually be a tool for strengthening business. Eric Galatas tells us about one example.
A few miles south of Durango, on a parcel of Florida Mesa land overlooking the Animas River, Jennifer Thurston is using an increasingly popular land conservation technique to ensure a viable long-term business that combines water-efficient farming with programs that help veterans groups and at-risk youths connect with nature and find healing. Thurston says creating a conservation easement for privately owned lands does not mean you have to shut down your business and find another way to make a living.
You are not altering your operation by any means at all. You are simply giving a guidance and a plan for next generations on how the land should be managed.
Working with La Plata Open Space Conservancy, Thurston was able to tap generous tax credits that can help finance her business venture, DSN Land, a public benefit corporation. The easement ensures that 180 acres will continue to be available as farmland far into the future. The move also maintains a small equestrian center and helps protect an adjacent 1,000-year-old archaeological area and important wildlife habitat. Thurston was moved to protect the farmlands and wild spaces her family has owned since the 1970s, in part because of rapid growth and conversion of open landscapes surrounding Durango. She notes development on migration corridors used by elk, deer, swift fox, bears, and mountain lions for thousands of years has led to increased animal-human conflict.
Private conservation spaces are very important. By having corridors protected where they can avoid human conflict and continue their natural patterns.
Between 2010 and 2020, the population of Durango grew by about 13%, and that growth is expected to continue. Thurston hopes other private landowners across Colorado will consider conservation easements as a viable alternative to selling property to developers looking to add strip malls or condos. She says that $1 million check from a developer will be spent and gone by the time the landowner's grandchildren come of age.
You're giving them nothing. A conservation easement allows you to ensure that something is going to be handed to that third generation with increased value.
This is Eric Galatas reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy, down to 31. Tomorrow's weather, overcast, and up to a high of 47. For today in history, we get some help from historian and author Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols. This day in 1778, two future presidents of the U.S., John Adams and his son, 10-year-old John Quincy Adams, were in Marblehead Harbor off the coast of Massachusetts on board the frigate Boston, which was about to take them to France, where John was going to replace Silas Dean to negotiate a treaty, an important part of our history. I know you've talked to me before about the Adams and how important they were in our history.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, the Adamses are fascinating figures. So, you know, there may be no more engaging first few presidents. You know, so John Quincy Adams is the sixth president, served from 1825 to 1829, and John Adams was the second president in 1797 to 1801. He's beaten by Thomas Jefferson with this kind of signal moment that changes, where you have the rise of party politics right there for the third presidency of the U.S., kind of Federalists and Anti-Federalists. And under Jefferson, they become Democratic Republicans, kind of vision of what sort of society the U.S. would want. It's not quite as starkly oppositional as kind of the popular view is there, but, you know, kind of yeoman farmers and agriculture being more of a Jeffersonian focus, and Adams being a little bit more focused on urban areas, industry, and that sort of thing. You know, the Adamses were really engaged with Europe and France, as was Jefferson, but both Adamses in terms of helping negotiate and put forward the treaty that you're just referring to, the Treaty of Amity and Commerce, I believe, is how it was termed then in 1778, by which you get the French into the war effort. And that's really crucial for the winning of the American Revolution and the way that revolution plays out. You know, you wouldn't have had a Yorktown without a French Navy. There's a lot of ways to think about that. And that, for me, as a historian who cares a lot about ideas and foreign policy and presidencies, one thing that you see in that moment is that this question of what kind of power in the world would the U.S. be? And an Adams orientation is as a neutral power, that the U.S. would not have strong alliances with other countries, that they would always be ad hoc and temporary, and so the U.S. wouldn't be pulled into power politics abroad. John Quincy Adams then builds that up in 1823 as the principal architect of the Monroe Doctrine, which was this argument that the U.S. would keep European powers from recolonizing the hemisphere, that there would be a kind of friendly feeling with all the new Republican governments of Central and South America, that the U.S. wouldn't intervene in those places, not yet in that era, but would really champion democratic causes in the hemisphere without then intervening a lot. And so I see John Quincy Adams building on that John Adams's legacy in really important and fascinating ways. And there's one more great trivia piece about John Quincy Adams. Years after he leaves the White House, he becomes this really renowned abolitionist. In fact, he defies the slave power in Congress, who put the so-called gag rule in, so you couldn't talk about slavery at all. Anytime you talked about slavery, it was ruled out of the congressional record. It was ruled not permitted, right? So talk about censorship. Right. And that's huge. It's far more than anything that Twitter has ever attempted. And this is public life. These are our representatives of government. But another thing that Adams was involved in, I mean, he sort of was everywhere back then, was he argued a Supreme Court case that led to the freeing of African slaves who were aboard the Amistad. That he argued this case and got them freed. I mean, just amazing long career. He comes back to Congress. He comes back into American public life all the way through the 1840s. He's watching the U.S. descend into the tumult that becomes the Civil War, and fighting very, very hard to prevent that. A really fascinating kind of life in politics and career. It, you know, for me, one of the things I take from that is just how important principle is to carry that through, you know, all of your acts, all of your time. And a certain core set of principles about democracy, about trying to expand rights to more people, you know, kind of generated both how Adams thought about what should happen in the hemisphere, even in other countries. There's a scholar who's talked about this in terms of our sister republics, that phrase, throughout the hemisphere. Same thing translated to people of color in the U.S., to enslaved folks, to African slaves, to indigenous peoples, although he had some blinders about their capacity, as did many people in that era. But as an abolitionist, he moved farther and faster than many others.
Anti-Semitism is on the rise in the United States, according to a new report from the American Jewish Committee. As Edwin J. Vieira reports, the road to solving it is paved with numerous challenges, including a lack of knowledge about the Jewish people.
A new report finds anti-Semitism is on the rise across the U.S., but awareness of its detriment is rising as well. The report from the American Jewish Committee finds 91% of Americans know anti-Semitism is a serious problem. According to the NYPD, hate crimes against Jewish people increased 11% from 2021 to 2022. Holly Huffnagel with the American Jewish Committee thinks it's great that more people are aware of anti-Semitism's harm, but she finds one issue in trying to combat it is people can't always identify it.
Many people actually, they might be mostly familiar with the term, but they don't know what anti-Semitism looks like or how to recognize it. That it's not just a hatred, that it's a conspiracy, that it's about power or control, and it looks different than other forms of racism. And so we, in our efforts, in our educational efforts, we always start with just being able to recognize it.
Huffnagel notes there are a slew of factors driving the rise in anti-Semitism, the most prevalent being social media. The report found 82% of Americans saw some form of anti-Semitism on social media, whereas 67% of American Jewish people reported seeing it online as well. But allaying fears of violence for Jewish people hasn't been so easy. The report finds 38% of Jewish people changed their behavior out of fear of anti-Semitism. Huffnagel notes there's plenty of questions about where anti-Semitism fits into ongoing fights against racism.
There's a blind spot in our society today with rightly fighting racism and victims who are perceived as inferior. And unfortunately, Jews still are a vulnerable minority group around the world. But something's missing when it comes to how do we fight anti-Semitism? How do we know who Jews are and how do we include them within diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives?
She adds, when it comes to combating anti-Semitism, law enforcement needs to be better at keeping Jewish people safe. Of the Orthodox Jewish people surveyed, 65% say law enforcement is effective in addressing their security needs. This is down from 81% in 2021. Huffnagel says the next steps are for society, alongside government officials and law enforcement, to take responsibility to educate people properly about anti-Semitism and Jewish people. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
The House GOP mulls budget cuts to raise the debt ceiling. Presidential hopeful Nikki Haley wants competency tests for older lawmakers. And Ohio's governor wants Congress to probe hazardous materials transportation. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Do the responsible thing. Raise the debt ceiling in a bipartisan way like we always have, and let's work together to fund the government.
Senator Patty Murray of Washington says spending cuts sought by House Republicans will put further strain on American households. The GOP has yet to offer a plan to cut spending in exchange for lifting the debt ceiling, but many Republicans have focused on non-defense items, including social programs, as a way to trim the budget. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has vowed to only allow a vote with no conditions attached. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says the U.S. risks a catastrophic default between July and September if the nation's debt limit is not raised. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley officially announced her candidacy for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination Wednesday.
And take it from me, the first minority female governor in history, America is not a racist country.
In her speech, Haley drew heavily on her background as the child of Indian immigrants. She also called for mandatory mental competency tests for politicians older than age 75. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says Congress must examine the February 3rd train derailment in East Palestine. He says Norfolk Southern Railroad was not required to notify the state that the train carried hazardous materials because they were not carried in every rail car.
Frankly, if this is true, and I'm told it's true, this is absurd.
Residents near the Ohio-Pennsylvania border were forced to evacuate their homes for several days and are still encouraged to drink from bottled water. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee heard testimony Wednesday regarding fentanyl trafficking. Dr. Raul Gupta, director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, says roughly 110,000 Americans died last year of drug overdoses involving synthetic opioids.
This crisis does more than cause tragic and preventable deaths. It is tearing the very fabric of our nation.
The U.S. sanctioned three fentanyl traffickers last month as part of a larger effort to break the fentanyl supply chain. Fake news became a popular defense for questions and stories former President Trump didn't like.
Well, when you report fake news, no, When you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people. Go ahead. Mr.
President. Now a new survey finds more than half of Americans believe national news organizations mislead or misinform the public. The Gallup poll finds just 35% of people believe most national news outlets can be relied on to deliver necessary information. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
More states are implementing financial literacy courses in high school. As Eric Tegedoff reports, legislation in Idaho could help many students who are currently lacking in basic money management skills.
Learning how to manage your finances is an important skill, but one that educators say many young people lack. A bill in the Idaho legislature would work to fix that with financial literacy courses for high school students. Todd Christensen is with CapEd Credit Union, which has branches in the Treasure Valley and Magic Valley, and works to teach young people about finances. He says research shows they lack the knowledge of many basic money management principles.
Recent surveys indicated that over 82% of high school seniors felt as though they didn't receive enough information to be prepared around financial literacy, checking accounts, saving accounts, debit cards, credit cards.
The legislation passed the House unanimously this week and has moved on to the Senate. It would require high schools to provide one or more courses in personal financial literacy. Idaho Superintendent of Public Instruction Debbie Critchfield is among the bill's supporters. Christensen says money management skills are important like other skills people learn in school.
We talk a lot about emotional intelligence. In this case, it's financial intelligence. Of how do you earn money and how do you best expend that money?
Idaho's credit unions provided nearly 3,800 hours of free financial education to students and adults in 2021. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Toronto's strawberry ceremony honors murdered and missing Indigenous people with a march and rally. Advocates in Minnesota also hold their first in-person event in 3 years. And an Arizona group prepares for a weekend event against the Oak Flat Mining Project. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
Indigenous people and their allies held events Tuesday in Canada to honor the memory of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Dan Karpinchuk reports on the annual strawberry ceremony.
A couple of hundred people gathered in downtown Toronto Tuesday in front of police headquarters. Many of them told stories about families that have lost loved ones. During the ceremony, people were given a cup of water and a strawberry to hold. When cut in half, the strawberries look like a heart. Organizers say the strawberries are part of the memorial because it's a woman's fruit and a symbol of hope and rebirth. Organizers say the gathering in Toronto has been taking place for the past 18 years, adding that it's an opportunity to gather as a community to pray for loved ones lost to violence. Joey Twin is an Indigenous activist.
My mom was murdered when I was 6 years old in Calgary, Alberta, 59 years ago, and no justice was served for her murder. And so it's been going on for many years, our Indigenous folks, you know, getting murdered, missing and murdered. And our nations aren't greedy, our Indigenous nations. We're just asking for the equality, for the justice for us. Because in this day and age, there's two laws, one for the white man and one for us Indians.
The ceremony has been taking place outside police headquarters because of what organizers call state complicity in the murders of Indigenous women, because of police inaction, and even as perpetrators of the violence. The ceremony comes as violence against Indigenous women continues. Last year, four women in Winnipeg were murdered. In its final report, the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls labeled the violence as genocide. The annual ceremony is hosted by No More Silence, a group dedicated to gathering the names of those missing and murdered since 2004. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An event to honor missing and murdered Indigenous people was held Tuesday in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It included a march and rally where advocates talked about raising awareness of MMIP and work being done to address the issue, including at the state level. State Senator Mary Kunish has been a strong advocate. She helped establish a missing and murdered Indigenous women task force and a missing and murdered Indigenous relatives office. In remarks, Kunish vowed to continue efforts as a Native lawmaker.
We will continue working at the legislature because, yes, representation matters.
The event was live streamed by the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, which sponsored the event along with a handful of other Native groups. This was the first in-person event in 3 years due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Members of the Apache Stronghold, a grassroots group fighting to save a sacred site, are planning a march and other events this week. They're opposed to a mining project slated for Oak Flat in Arizona. Alex Gonzalez has more.
Resolution Copper is a joint venture by Rio Tinto and BHP. Both organizations say the mine will bring thousands of jobs to the area. But Vanessa Nosey with the Apache Stronghold says Oak Flat is ancestral and sacred land. She believes the project would destroy the land and their way of life. Nosey says as a mother of four girls, she feels it's her job to protect them and their culture.
If Oak Flat is gone, I can't pass that on. And who we are spiritually, we'd be gone forever. It's the same tactic that the United States government has always used on Indian people.
The protest events begin this Thursday. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals hears an appeal next month that seeks to prohibit the transfer of sacred tribal lands, with Oak Flat at the center of the controversy. The land transfer to Resolution Copper was part of the 2014 National Defense Authorization Act. Apache Stronghold has argued that it violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 16th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tagadoff, Edwin J. Vera, and Roz Brown. Producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service, Native Voice One, and Dr. Chris Nichols. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth coming up next.